We're considering the letter of Paul to the Galatians, and we've been going through the first two chapters at breakneck speed, because what we have here is narrative. The Apostle Paul does away with formalities, because there is an emergency in the churches in Galatia. The false teachers, the Judaizers, have come in, and they've twisted the message of the gospel, and they have said that unless you keep the Jewish law as well as believing in Jesus Christ, you are not truly saved. And as a result of that, many of the Christians in these churches were bound and had lost the joy of their salvation, as well as their raison d'etre. And Paul gets in straight away to defending not just the gospel, but his own authority, because one of the other things these Judaizers did was to shoot the messenger, the Apostle Paul, and have a smear campaign against him. But in chapters 1 and 2, he's been defending himself, not because he's getting back at the false teachers, but because he's concerned for the honor of God and for the purity of the gospel. And he's been showing the Galatians and us that this gospel isn't a second-hand gospel. He received it from Christ himself, and that he's not preaching a different gospel to the other leaders of the church. The gospel that Peter preached is the same as that which Paul preached. And he proves that by showing that he had the right hand of fellowship of Peter, James, and John, the pillars of the church. He needed that affirmation. He was human, you see. He was sensitive. And we need that today, don't we? We really need to know what it is to have unity in the gospel, not just in words, but in action as well. And then he is standing firm for the truth. He isn't so in need of support from others that he is tied to them. He is ready to rebuke Peter to his face when there is need for that. And that's the blend we need to have today. We need to be sensitive, to have the heart of a child, and at the same time, we need to be men and women of granite, to stand according to scriptural principles. So it doesn't matter who the person may be. He may have been mightily used by the Lord, and we may offend others in making a stand, but if somebody is going against the Bible, then the truth comes before any emotional ties we may have. So that's where we left off the apostles' defense. And I just want to read, we're just going over some verses we looked at last time, verse 11 of chapter 2, and we'll read down to verse 16, maybe. But when Peter was come to Antioch, I withstood him to the face, because he was to be blamed. For before that certain came from James, he did eat with the Gentiles. But when they were come, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing them which were of the circumcision. And the other Jews dissembled likewise with him, insomuch that Barnabas also was carried away with their dissimulation. But when I saw that they walked not uprightly according to the truth of the gospel, I said unto Peter before them all, If thou, being a Jew, livest after the manner of Gentiles, and not as do the Jews, why compellest thou the Gentiles to live as do the Jews? We who are Jews by nature and not sinners of the Gentiles, knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but by the faith of Jesus Christ, even when we have believed in Jesus Christ, that we might be justified by the faith of Christ and not by the works of the law. For by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified. Now that's what we need to concentrate on this morning. That's brilliant statements of the gospel in verse 16. You see, you have to admire this great man of God. Here he is putting his own case before these readers, and as soon as he starts talking about the gospel, and this is a quotation of what he said to Peter when he withstood him to the face, he cannot help but get carried away. And in doing that, he frustrates us, doesn't he? Because he breaks all the rules of grammar. And we don't get back to the main point until chapter 3, verse 1. Because once he starts to get going on the gospel of grace, he says in verse 17, you see, he's off on one of his inspired tangents. But if while we seek to be justified by Christ, we ourselves are also found sinners, is therefore Christ the minister of sin? God forbid. And then a little later, verse 20, I am crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. His heart is in it. Oh, that we would get carried away more by the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, listen to Martin Luther here. He got carried away as well with the gospel. This is how he puts it. Why, Paul, are you getting so excited here in your defense? Why can't you just make the statement about the gospel and leave it at that and then proceed to the next point? Why do you get carried away? This is Luther's reasoning. This is the truth of the gospel. It is also the principal article of all Christian doctrine, wherein the knowledge of all godliness consisteth. Most necessary it is, therefore, that we should know this article well, teach it unto others, and here's Luther for you, and beat it into their heads continually. That's what the Apostle Paul is doing to the Galatians, and may the Lord, not me, do that to you this morning. You know, you hear it said of some people that they're obsessed about a certain subject. We had somebody in university who was obsessed about the timing of the second coming of Christ. You know, the people who have all these charts and they're able to predict the exact coming of Christ in relation to world events. And he was forever giving us tapes of sermons regarding the second coming. And we nicknamed this person Somebody Tapes. I won't say his first name. Well, surely, if a person could get obsessed about the timing of the second coming, it is more spiritually healthy to get obsessed about Jesus Christ himself and about what he's done for us. Listen to Luther again. If the article of justification be once lost, then is all true Christian doctrine lost. This is the pillar on which everything else is built. If this goes, you don't have anything. Now then, what are we going to do then in looking at this tangent? Well, we're going over old ground here. I'm not ashamed of doing that because that's what the Apostle Paul is doing. And may the Lord beat it into our heads. What is it, this issue, that we're always coming back to? God is righteous, and he's got to punish sin. His anger isn't like us when we lose our tempers. That's often wrong. But with God, it's the instinctive reaction of a pure and a holy being to that which is unclean and unholy. We are unrighteous. It doesn't matter how refined we may be. We are not 100% clean. And therefore, we're under the judgment of God. And our greatest need is to be made right with God. The question propounded by Job, how can a man be just with God? The problem that confronts us this morning is, how can God be just and the justifier of him that believes in Jesus? He cannot just wink at our sin. How can he retain his righteousness on the one hand, and in his love forgive people like ourselves? That's the issue. And the answer is here in verse 16. So what we have here is Paul, in verse 16, making the statements that it's only through Jesus Christ that we are righteous. And then in verses 17 to 21, he deals with an objection to this gospel of grace, a common objection, and that is, well, if that's the case, then I can do what I like. And he says, no, it's not like that at all. Because when you do believe in Jesus Christ, new life is implanted within you, and you begin to live the life of Christ. Justification by faith does not mean easy believism, and that I do whatever I want from here onwards because I've got a ticket to heaven. Not at all. I now love him who first loved me. And so what we'll do in looking at verse 16, looking at this definition of the gospel, is consider the two possibilities of how to be made right with God. There are only two ways, and only one of them is right. So it's a very simple way of dividing this verse. The first way is by the works of the law. What's the law here? Well, it's summed up in the Ten Commandments, but it includes all that you have in the Old Testament, the ceremonial and the civic laws as well. But for us, it's the moral law of God, the Ten Commandments, and there is nothing wrong with them. We have to say that today because many people are casting doubt on the keeping of the law. The law is good and holy. It's an expression of God's will for his people. But the Lord never gave us the Ten Commandments in order that through keeping them, we would be accepted by him and get to heaven. So the statement here, it's so blatantly clear. Knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law. We read from Romans chapter 3, because you have the same statements there. That's probably the most famous part of the Bible, dealing with justification by faith. And you have the summing up in Romans 3, verse 28. Therefore, we conclude that a man is justified by faith without the deeds of the law. Now then, somebody may be asking this morning, why can't I go to heaven on the basis of my keeping of the Ten Commandments? This is how John Stott puts it. Justification by works has been the religion of the ordinary man, both before the New Testament and since. It is the religion of the man on the street today. Indeed, it is the fundamental principle of every religion and moral system in the world, except New Testament Christianity. That's true. Either you're a true Christian this morning in Christ, or you're trying to justify yourself by the keeping of the law. And what Paul is telling us here is that if that's your route to heaven, there is a locked door before you with the sign, no admittance. In John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, you have there Christian trying at first to justify himself by the deeds of the law, and he comes against Mount Sinai, and he just cannot get past Mount Sinai. It's so rocky that the precipices are overhanging him and it's about to fall down on him. By the deeds of the law shall no flesh be justified in his sight. Now, is there anybody here this morning trying to make themselves acceptable before God by good works? And we're not saying anything against good works in and of themselves. By religious deeds, by coming to church, by reading the Bible, by praying. Is that what you're depending on in order to get to heaven? That's what it is to justify yourself by the deeds of the law. Now, why can't we be accepted in this way? Well, the law doesn't just deal with our outward actions. It deals with the motive. That was the mistake that the Pharisees made. They limited the Ten Commandments to the outward, and they thought that because they had never murdered somebody, that they were innocent of that. Because they'd never slept with somebody outside of marriage, that they were innocent of that. And so, in their pride, they added hundreds of other rules as well, of their own making, to the commandments of God. But when we considered the Sermon on the Mount, we heard the interpretation of the lawgiver, the Lord Jesus Christ. And this is how he puts it. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgments. That's how the Pharisees interpreted it. And they breathed a sigh of relief because it was all right. But I say unto you, that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgments. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. And whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. Now, who here hasn't been guilty of that? We've all been there. This anger welling up within our hearts. And that is murder in the sight of God, as much as killing somebody. The motive. Or take adultery. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery, but I say unto you, that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. That's me. Guilty. And if you were honest with yourself, it's you as well. The mirror of God's law shows us as we really are. There's no, in the supermarkets these days, they put some colouring, don't they, in the mirror, so that when you look at yourself in them, you look healthier than you really are. Well, it's not like that with God's law. It tells it as it is. So it shows us the motive as well as the outward action. I'm glad that you don't know what imaginations go through this head. I'm glad that they don't show what this heart often thinks upon. But God sees. And then there's something else about the law of God. If you're trying to keep it in order to get to heaven, do you know what the pass mark is? When I was in school, the pass mark was 50%. I think it's a bit lower now, is it? I don't know. But if you want to keep God's law and be accepted by him on the last day, the pass mark, you know what it is? Maybe you're thinking 70%, that's the pass mark for an A. No, not 70%. What about 80%? A star. That's good going. No. 100%. You see, if you keep the whole law, James says, and yet fall in one point, so that's 90.9%, you are still guilty of breaking it all. Now, who here has kept the whole law, just thinking of outward things, perfectly? None of us have. So we all have to plead guilty before God. If the pass mark is 100%, none of us can claim a right to heaven through justifying our own deeds by the works of the law. And then there's something else about the law. When somebody asked the Lord Jesus Christ to sum up the law, this is how he puts it. I'm paraphrasing here now. He said, it can be summed up in 2 points. You shall love the Lord your God with your whole being. That's the first part. And you shall love your fellow man as yourself, the second half. That's the force of the law. And the poor Pharisees were completely missing the mark. They were not governed by love. You know, they were looking down their noses upon other people. You have a perfect description of people who are trying to justify themselves by the works of the law, especially the religious sort of people. In Romans chapter 10, this is how they're described. They being ignorant of God's righteousness, of the gospel, and going about to establish their own righteousness. Isn't that a very graphic description of the religious hypocrites? Holier than thou, always judging others, never seeing anything wrong in himself. Very well then, I'm holding before you the law, the mirror of the law, showing you as you really are, the pass mark of the law, 100%, and the raison d'etre of the law, not just a mechanical keeping of the commands, but a love to God, a love to those round about me, a love every second of the day, a love that motivates everything that I do. Oh, no wonder even a great and a godly man as Wesley, when confronted with such claims, had to put his own position like this. Just and holy is thy name. I am all unrighteousness. Foul and full of sin I am. Thou art full of truth and grace. Doesn't matter who you are. There's no such thing as first class and second class sinners. We're all in the same boat. So I don't want anybody to think this morning that they can justify themselves by the deeds of the law. I want to so beat this into your heads that you go from this place utterly discouraged in trying to get to heaven that way. I'm not doing it because I'm a hard person. I'm doing it because I know there's no entry. And I know that if you keep on going this way, you will end up being under the judgment of God forever. There's a lovely hymn in Welsh which talks about a poor sinner condemned and aware of his guilt, going to Mount Sinai, thinking that the law can help him to get to heaven. And he comes to this mount of thunder, and he is convicted even more. And you know what Mount Sinai says to him? There's no way to get to heaven here. You need to go to another mountain, to Mount Calvary. And the sinner runs there as soon as he can get there. I've been reading some of the letters of Newton recently, and as he was getting on in age, he wrote these lovely words: "My memory is nearly gone." This is Newton now, not me. "But I remember two things." What two things stuck in his mind that age wasn't able to erase? Listen to this. Present tense now. So he's been a Christian for many years. He's written some of the best hymns in our English language. He's been a pastor of pastors. He's been a man of God. And yet, he's aware of this at the present moment. The first thing, that I'm a great sinner. And the second thing, and that Jesus Christ is a great Savior. So I want us to look at the second way to be justified, the only way, really. Justification by faith. Oh, I hope you don't find this dry and monotonous, having to go over this old ground. You know, when I go up Snowdon, I always go up the same way, even though I've been up that way so many times now that I've lost count. There's something new every time. And on this way to Calvary, there are new sights to be seen. Just as we remember the Lord's death in terms of coming around his table twice a month, oh, how we should come to the cross more often. There's a hymn which puts it like this. Oh, listen to the experience of this man. "Beneath the cross of Jesus, I fain would take my stand. The shadow of a mighty rock within a weary land, a home within the wilderness, a rest upon the way, from the burning of the noontide heats and the burden of the day." Are you weary? Are you laboring at the moment, about to faint in the heat of the day? Then come to this place of refreshment and look at the one there dying for sinners. Oh, safe and happy shelter. Oh, refuge tried and sweet. Oh, trusting place where heaven's love and heaven's justice meet. How can God be just and the justifier of him that believes in Jesus? Well, here's the way. Listen to Paul first, and then we'll expand on it. "Knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but by the faith of Jesus Christ." There's no mention of our faith to begin with. It's Christ. Only one person has ever kept the law of God perfectly. If he stood before the mirror of God's law, there would be no imperfections. His motives were always pure when he was here on earth. He passed. "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased," said the Father of him. And he loved his God with all his might. And he loved his fellow men, even his enemies. That's the gospel. You can't get any simpler than that, can you? It's not our keeping of the law, but Christ keeping of it on our behalf that counts. He only is good enough to unlock the gates of heaven and let us in. That scene in the book of Revelation of the book that is sealed, and no one is found worthy to open the seal. And poor John is in distress. And is that you at this moment? You have heard about the law of God, and you know in your heart of hearts that you are not right with God, and that it's over unless something happens. Who is worthy? And to be told that one has been found worthy. Isn't that good news? That Jesus Christ, the eternal Son of God, came down to this world and became one of us. Do you remember hearing about a week ago about Johnny Depp? I'm no fan of his, but Johnny Depp visiting a school assembly. A girl was writing to him and they were going to do something out of the Pirates of the Caribbean. Apparently Johnny Depp is the main star. I've never seen the film myself. And on the off chance that he might come, she wrote him a letter. And that morning, they were doing assembly and they had a few people acting scenes from the Pirates of the Caribbean. And then this other pilot comes on the stage. And he looks like Johnny Depp. He is Johnny Depp. And he's come to visit us. Well, how much greater God the Son visiting this sin-sick world. And not just for an appearance, but living in our midst so that he could keep the law for us. Every time you break the law, he's kept it for you. And then, in order that God might be just in forgiving us, going to a cross, and by being condemned in my place, the wrath of God is deflected away from me and taken by him so that I can be forgiven and go free. That's how it happens. The hymns, you see, they're so full of this. Stuart Townend, we don't have his hymns here, but he is as full of justification by faith as many of the old hymnists. But listen to this old hymn. On the Mount of Crucifixion, we'll be remembering this shortly. Fountains open deep and wide, through the floodgates of God's mercy flowed a vast and gracious tide. Grace and love, God doesn't delight in the death of the wicked. God desires that we should be saved. Grace and love, like mighty rivers, poured incessant from above. How can he be just and still forgive us guilty sinners? Here's the answer. Heaven's peace and perfect justice meeting together on the cross and kissing a guilty world in love. The Son has kept the law. It's been honored. And he takes the punishment of the broken law so that God now can forgive. Well, there you have it. Don't you want to have this beaten into your head? We should go every day to Calvary. Every look within at our sin requires 10 looks to the cross. Now, as we come to a conclusion, we need to look in detail at verse 16. So he's made the statement that no one is justified in terms of the works of the law by keeping them themselves. The only way to get to heaven is through what Jesus Christ has done, and we believe in him. By the faith of Jesus Christ, thy works, not mine, O Christ, speak gladness to this heart. They tell me all is done. They bid my fear depart. And then we believe in Jesus Christ, that we might be justified by the faith of Christ, not by our faith, but by what Christ has done, and not by the works of the law. So I take him. That's faith for you. We sang in that a lovely hymn, nothing in my hands I bring, simply to thy cross I cling. Now look at verse 16 in greater detail. We've got the general statements that we're justified by the faith of Jesus Christ. That's the general statements. And if I can put it like this, without being misunderstood, that's the theory. Right? Now, are you asking yourself, like me, why is Paul then repeating it in a slightly different way? Even we have believed in Jesus Christ. Well, that's no longer theory. He's speaking there from his own experience. Isn't that lovely? So as he's dealing here with the gospel of grace, justification by faith alone, he cannot help but give his testimony. I found it to be so. I'm not just propounding the truth of Christianity here. I'm telling you that I've experienced it. This is the difference between an advocate and a witness. Have you seen an advocate in court defending his case? He may be very eloquent in doing that. He may win the argument, but all he's doing is the theoretical. A witness, on the other hand, is giving a word of experience. A witness was there. A witness saw it with his own eyes. And that's what we are as Christians when we come to this gospel. Some are advocates. They may be able to explain this way of salvation far more better than I can. They may have bigger brains than me. But it doesn't count unless you believe in Jesus Christ and experience it for yourself. You don't have to understand the cross in a detailed way. All you have to do is trust him. You see, that's rescue in the mine in Chile. They sent that pod, I think, or rockets down. It wasn't a real rocket, but it looked like a rocket, but it was a pod. And it was sent down. Now, a person didn't have to understand the mechanics of that in order to be saved. All he had to do was go into it. And that's what you have to do with Christ. I believed in Jesus Christ. I'm doing the same as the Apostle Paul here. I'm giving my testimony. I believed in him. In university, I knew I couldn't be saved by the keeping of the works of the law, that he'd done everything. I didn't see more than that. But I just put my trust in him. And later on, I came to understand justification by faith. So have you a word of experience? This is my story. Have you a story of how God came to you and gave you faith to trust in Jesus Christ? And then, and I finish here, he ends with an universal statement, not just theory, not even experience, but by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified. How we need to be reminded of that. You see, it's becoming the vogue in missionary circles now. This is what our missionaries have told me, that you prepare the way for the gospel. Now, of course, there is an element of preparing. I believe missionaries need to be aware of their culture, to be all things to all men. But there are some missionary organizations that go as far as saying that if you're a Christian and being a missionary in an Islamic country, you must become a Muslim. That's how far it's gone. And the problem is they don't get to the cross soon enough. They may spend years preparing the way to Calvary. I remember reading of a missionary who was trying to do this and he wasn't seeing much fruit. And the Lord convicted it to his heart. And what he did the next day was just preach the cross. He used illustrations that the people he was ministering to were familiar with. For example, if you're in Greenland, you cannot use some illustrations. Or if you're in the tropics, you cannot use some things. To talk about snow there would cause confusion. But oh, how we here need to get to this cross. He die, me no more die. And in preaching to all people, whatever the culture, how we need to get to Calvary. And whatever work in the church you're involved in, whether it's preaching in the open air, whether it's speaking to children, whether it's going into an old people's home to tell them the gospel. Oh, my friends, as I'm trying to make this effort to get to that cross, so you also placard Christ crucified before the people, for there is none other way, none other name but this, for his name's sake.